Well, all right. Let's open up our Bibles to the book of Leviticus, and we are in. We're going to begin tonight here in chapter 11. You know, one of the strange things that I've seen in really recent years is that as Sherry and I, as we were in our 20s and we were starting to have our children and build our family, and we're hanging out with people of the same age, and our kids are going to school together and going to Sunday school together and those kinds of things. And I have really seen in recent years how that many of those kids, in fact, I would probably say the majority of those kids that ran in that circle that we were in, that the majority of them today have really renounced the faith. The majority of those, and a lot of them are homeschoolers. And you know, I'll see them on you know, Facebook, and very antagonistic towards the church. They have a heightened sense of the hypocrisy that's in the church. They have a very judgmental view of Christianity. And one of the things that I sort of get a chuckle out of, because it's really revealing their ignorance, is that they talk about, well, you know, if you guys really believe that the Bible's a Bible, you know, why are you eating shellfish? And, you know, why aren't you doing this holiday and doing that holiday? And it just reveals that they have no understanding that the Mosaic covenant, the covenant of Moses, has nothing to do with New Testament believers. We're going to get to it in Hebrews chapter 8, in verse 7, where the writer will say, if the first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no need for a second covenant to replace it, right? Mark that word, replace. It has been replaced. We are not on the hook to keep any of the Mosaic law. Now again, you go back and you look into the ancient world, they had what was known as suzerain treaties. And what a suzerain was is that a suzerain was, it was a king. And it was a king that had conquered a city-state, a nation. The city-state, the nation, they raised the white flag. Hey, we're not going to fight you. We surrender. We'll give up. Come here. We'll kiss your feet. We'll do whatever it is that we have to do in order that we might breathe, you know, one more day. And so what would happen is that the king would say, all right, you've got to be assimilated now into my kingdom. And how you're going to be, and we have found all kinds of these things in the ancient world. And the king would say, all right, now look, this is the clothing that you're going to wear. This is the food that you're going to eat. These are the holidays that you're going to keep. And you know, it would be like if the United States today, we went and we beat somebody up and we said to them, we should nuke you, but you know, we're not going to nuke you. But this is what we're going to do. You're going to keep 4th of July holiday, all right? You're going to roast some hot dogs on that day. You're going to keep Thanksgiving. By golly, you're going to give up that cricket, and you're going to start playing baseball like a real man. And, you know, you're going to have apple pie. And it's all about trying to get this outside force to become assimilated into our culture. And that is exactly what we have here. The Lord says to Israel, look, I'm going to be your God, and you're going to be my people. Now, this is going to be your diet. This is going to be the kind of clothes you're going to wear. These are the holidays that you're going to keep. This is the music. This is the worship that I want the nation. And as long as you follow this treaty, you will be known as my people. So where we find ourselves now in chapter 11, the priesthood is up and running. For the first time, you remember Aaron and his sons now, they're sacrificing. The tabernacle is fully functional. They're getting ready to pull up stakes and head to the promised land. And how exciting is that going to be? And now, as we get into chapter 11 and chapter 12, we're going to get into the dietary and the public health issues. What are the Lord's people supposed to eat, and how are the Lord's people to interact with each other when it comes to public health? Health types of things. So beginning in verse 1, it's very interesting to me that it says that now the Lord spoke unto Moses and Aaron, saying unto them. So understand this, the claim is from God's mouth to your ears. The claim is, what we are about ready to read has come to us from God Almighty. Now, is that reasonable to believe? Is it reasonable to believe that these next several chapters are the direct commandments of God? Now, one of the things that intrigues me is that when you go back to that time in history and you see what these various cultures were up to, whether it was Assyrian, Babylonian, Egyptian, and you begin to look at their public health standards, you begin to look at what they called medicine, you begin to look at how they treated disease, how they treated wounds and so forth, and compare them to what Moses is claiming God told him. There's absolutely no comparison at all. For example, in Egypt, for toothaches, you pulverize a dead mouse. You make it into a paste, and then you slather it on your gums. For a really bad toothache, an entire dead mouse should be applied. This is so-called medicine at the time of Moses. They also, Egyptian physicians, used human and animal excrement as a cure-all remedy for diseases and injuries, which, of course, would lead to tetanus and other infections. Now, from the book Evolution and Genesis. Now you just think about this. We ask the question, since Moses was educated in all of these Egyptian superstitions and primitive practices, how does it happen that he does not teach or recommend these remedies in his writings? Although he deals in detail and great length with disease, the treatment of infections, leprosy, running sores, yet gross errors and superstitions concerning anatomy, physiology, pathology, and the treatment of diseases as taught in the schools of learning in Egypt, from which Moses was a graduate, are never taught or even suggested in the books of Moses. But instead, the instructions Moses laid down for Israel were utterly at variance with the accepted practices of that day and fully in harmony with modern day scientific fact. So look, this guy says, this is what God told me. Number one, it has nothing in common with what was common in Babylon, Assyria, or Egypt. These treatments, which of course would make the disease, make the infection even worse. And now all of a sudden he begins to put forth things. Look, there isn't anything that you can find in the public health standards of Israel that is not consistent with known science today. We can go back and we can laugh at the Egyptians and laugh at the Assyrians and so forth. But when you look at what Moses claimed that he received from God, there's nothing for us to laugh at. He's going to talk about, now look, you got to quarantine people. Look, this is what you've got to do with solid waste. This is what you have to do with a dead animal. This is what we have to do when body fluid is an issue here. And all of these things are very consistent with what we know to be true today. So is it reasonable that this guy received this insight from God himself? I would have to say yes. It indeed is reasonable. Now, let's notice what the Lord says to him concerning the diet. Speak to the children of Israel, saying, these are the animals which you may eat among all of the animals that are on the earth. Among the animals, whatever divides the hoof, having cloven hooves and chewing the cud, that you may eat. Nevertheless, these you shall not eat among those that chew the cud and those that have not cloven hooves. For example, the camel, because it chews the cud, but it does not have a cloven hoof, it is unclean to you. Now, I want you to understand that he never calls these animals unhealthy. He never says, well, if you eat this, you're going to be unhealthy. Notice the terminology that he uses there. It is unclean. Now, what does unclean mean? Unclean, it means foul in a religious sense. It has the idea of being defiled. It has the sense that it is moving me farther away from the Lord. It has the idea that it's placing me outside of fellowship with my God. God is saying, this is what I want you to eat. Now, if I reject that and I say, no, I'm going to do the opposite of what you're asking me to do, well, then it's going to move me outside of fellowship. What we have to understand is that the diet for Israel was not for health reasons. It was for holiness reasons. It was pointing them out that they are a different people. So when your child would say, hey, mommy and daddy, why aren't we eating the pig like the Canaanite pagan neighbors down the street? And it would give an opportunity for mommy and daddy to say, look, we're different. We belong to our God, and the treaty that we have established between ourselves and our God is that this is the food that we are to be partaking in. Now, notice there's two characteristics here. Had to look at the foot, had to look at the mouth. If the foot was right and the mouth was right, if it was a split hoof, and if they would then ruminate, if they would bring the priorly eaten food up once again and kind of chew on it, well, then it's okay. Notice that the two have to be in agreement. What causes something to be unclean is when the foot is contrary to the mouth, right? When there's consistency with what's going on in the mouth and there's consistency with what's going on in the foot, then it's clean. And you and I, we need to make sure that we're walking the talk. We need to make sure that what we're talking, we're also walking, and what we're walking, we're also talking, so to speak. And when there is consistency in that area, it is clean before the Lord. Now, he gets into, you can't eat pigs and these other types of animals. Notice verse 10, we get into some seafood issues here. But all of the seas, or in all of the seas, or in the rivers that do not have fins or scales, all that move in the water, or any living thing which is in the water, these are an abomination to you. They shall be an abomination to you. You shall not eat their flesh, but you shall have regard to their carcasses as an abomination. So shellfish were out. Notice that in order to eat aquatic life, so to speak, it had to have fins, and it had to have scales. So catfish are out. They got fins, but they, of course, do not have scales. And eels and these kinds of things. He gets into these various birds that can and cannot be eaten. Very interesting, in verse 19, the stork, the heron after its kind, the hoopoe, I'm not sure what that was, and the bat. Now look, you only need to tell me one time not to eat a bat, and I'm with you on that. You don't need to repeat yourself. Now, there are people that will say, oh, come on. You mean your Bible is so dumb that it doesn't know that a bat isn't a bird? But when we back up to verse 13, that word bird there, it means flying creature. So these are the things flying through the atmosphere that you can and cannot eat, which as you continue down here, you also see that it includes insects and so forth. And again, he then gets into, if it's got a paw, you can't eat an animal with a paw, right? So kitty cats, can't eat cats. By the way, this is why there were no Chinese restaurants in ancient Israel, if you wanted to know that. And then he continues to talk about reptiles. You're not to eat reptiles and those things that are creep. I love that word, creep around. Notice verse 31. These are unclean, you among all that creep, and whoever touches them when they are dead, they shall be unclean until evening. So he starts talking about these carcasses and what you do with a dead animal. Many people don't realize that during the Black Death, when Europe was in the grips of the Black Death, most Europeans blamed the Jews. And it was very interesting. They blamed the Jews because the Jewish population had fewer incidents than what was found in the general population. And so the general population became suspicious. Ah, you guys, you must have started this. It must be a big conspiracy. And so a lot of Jews were burned at the stake, and horrible things happened to them. Very interesting book called The Jews of Europe After the Black Death. The author says this: Jews were less affected because they had many laws that promoted cleanliness. A Jew must wash their hands before eating, after using the bathroom. It was customary for them to bathe at least once a week. And they also had these regulations on what you did with dead animals. They did not let a dead rat stay on their porch so the kids could poke at it with sticks and all. They got rid of it. So it was the very issues of hygiene that actually kept them so healthy when the rest of Europe was dropping like flies. So now he gets into very, very interesting. He starts getting into some of these water issues. You've got to have clean water. Notice verse 34, talking about if a dead animal hits the water or a vessel, in such a vessel, any edible food which water falls, it becomes unclean, and any drink that may be drunk from it, it becomes unclean. Now, what it's talking about, you want to have coffee in the morning. You don't want to walk down early in the morning to the well. So you take your clay pot late afternoon, early evening, the night before, fill up the pot. You got it sitting there on the kitchen counter, and you're going to pour it into the coffee maker first thing in the morning. And as you're pouring the water into the coffee maker, here comes a dead mouse out of it. Now, what he's saying is that you got to start all over. Oh, man, I got to go back down to the well again. I got to break the clay pot, right? And again, we can see that this all has to do with the spreading of disease. We can see that it all has to do with infection. In fact, very interesting, from the book Modern Discovery in the Bible, the importance of clean water supply is one of the major discoveries of the modern public health services. It was only around 1900 that it became recognized that typhoid fever in Great Britain, cholera in India, and many other diseases were spread principally by polluted water. And so here the Lord is saying to Moses, look, you got to guard over this. If something happens in a negative way to your water, you just don't chug it down anyway. There's some bad heebie-jeebies in that water. Throw it out, go back down to that clean water supply and get it all, get your new water all over again. Now notice how this chapter closes out. In verse 44, notice, for I am the Lord your God. Notice verse 45, for I am the Lord that brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. Now you therefore be holy, for I am holy. So the Lord closes this by saying, look, do what I'm asking you to do. I'm God. You are not God. I am God. I want to have a relationship with you. I need you to be holy as I am holy. I need you to respect the rules of the house, so to speak. If you want to be members of my house, you've got to honor the rules of this house. Now, there could have been people that would say, it's just a piece of catfish, all right? Why can't I have? And the Lord is saying, don't have a cat, have the tilapia, all right? I don't want you to have it. Well, why can't I have it? Now, look, we understand that we train ourselves and we condition ourselves for obedience primarily through the little things, the little right things that we do in our life. And the Lord knows that if you'll be faithful every day of your life to say no to catfish and no to bats and no to some of these other. Now, the Lord is saying, go get yourself a nice lamb chop, all right? Go out there and get yourself, you know, this piece of meat or that. Look, I don't want you to have this. And you and I train ourselves in obedience. And if we will spend our week saying no to catfish, then it enables us at the end of the week when we are tempted to be unfaithful to our spouse and there needs to be big obedience. Well, we're conditioned to keep the big obedience because we're faithful with giving God the little obedience throughout the days of our life. Look, if we had like a marriage seminar, and so we're going to have a couple here, and they're going to be sharing their story, and maybe it's a story of infidelity, the wife or the husband, or maybe both of them. And if you listen very carefully to their testimony, I will bet you anything that what they will be saying is things like, well, we started to drift. well, we began to let things, you know, just drift away. We began to be a little undisciplined. We really weren't praying with each other anymore. We really weren't doing any kind of devotional life. We really weren't giving each other that, you know, non-sexual touch. And we really weren't communicating with each other. And we weren't taking care of the little things, and it opened us up for the big attack. And so here the Lord is saying, it might seem like a little thing to you, but it's a big deal to me. And our obedience in those little things so oftentimes sets the stage for victory over the big temptations and the big mountains that we have facing ourselves. Now, notice in verse 1, this is very interesting as we get into some of this public health stuff here. He says, "Then the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, I'll speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a woman has conceived and she's born a male child," so she has a little baby boy, "then she shall be unclean for 7 days, as in the days of her customary impurity, and she shall be unclean." So again, here's a woman now that she's had this little boy, and so for 7 days, she is to be quarantined. Now again, there's been probably physical damage that has been done to her in the delivery of the child. There has been blood loss. There's body fluids involved in all of this stuff. We understand how disease can be easily transmitted in body fluids. And so look, let's make sure after she has the child that for 7 days she is totally and completely isolated. Now, notice in verse 3, "And on the 8th day, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised." The idea is to be cut around. "And she shall then continue in the blood of her purification for 33 days. And she shall not touch any hollow thing, nor come into the sanctuary until the days of her purification are fulfilled." So we got her in isolation, right? She's there for a week. So after 7 days, on the 8th day, she comes out. She's got her little baby boy. And they go through the circumcision ritual. They go through the purification ritual of offering the various sacrifices, the burnt offering and the sin offering. And then right after those ceremonies, she goes right back now for a month time, family leave act, okay? She goes right in there for a month, and she's just hanging out. It's just her and her little baby all by themselves. And no doubt this is a great time of bonding with the child. Now, again, why the 8th day? And people could say, I think God's narrow. I'm busy on the 8th day, all right? I want to do it on the 9th day. I want to do it on the 7th day. I want to do it on the 15th day. Look, God said do it on the 8th day. He's not an idiot. We have to keep reminding ourselves over and over again, God is not an idiot. Very interesting, in 1935, vitamin K was discovered. Now, the thing about vitamin K is that it produces prothrombin in the liver. And prothrombin is a coagulant. It enables the blood to coagulate. And it's interesting, from the 3rd to the 7th day in a male baby, there is an exponentially increase when it comes to vitamin K in that little boy's body. There is an explosion of vitamin K, and the result is that on the 8th day, there is a greater percentage of prothrombin in that male child than at any day over the course of the rest of his life. And you can see when you gauge it out, from 3 to 7, vitamin K is going through the roof. And then on the 8th day, you find a peak with this prothrombin. And of course, this would allow the child the greatest opportunity not to bleed out. This is going to be the one day in that child's life that he is least likely to bleed to death. God is not an idiot. He is the architect of the human body. And there's a reason why he said the 8th day. And many times in our life, the Lord will say something We have no clue as to why. People ask me, why did the Lord say? I don't know why the Lord, but I know this. He is not a fool. And if he tells you to do something on a certain day, you're the fool if you don't follow his instructions. So do not give pushback to the Lord. Understand he's far more intelligent than us. He knows what's going on there. Just do what the Lord asks you to do. Now, fascinating now, verse 5. But if she bears a female child, then she shall be unclean for 2 weeks, as in the customary impurity, and she shall continue there in the blood of her purification. Notice now, for 66 days. So twice the time that she was to be in isolation for the little boy, she is to be in isolation for her little girl. Now, I have heard all kinds of, and I think guys really are trying too hard to, you know, find a spiritual reason for this stuff. And, you know, you'll hear Bible teachers talk about, well, you know, we got these sinners that have come into the world, all right, so we got to isolate. You know, now, I want you to notice the babies are not unclean. Will you mark it carefully? It is the mother that is unclean. It is the mother that is to be separated. God doesn't hate babies, all right? And what's going on here is that, look, when a male child is born, it has spent time in the womb where its body is being washed over with testosterone. And one of the things that testosterone does is that it enables the fetus to put on weight. And that is why, on average, baby boys weigh more than baby girls. Very interesting. It's beginning now. Baby girls are beginning to catch up in the United States. They think that it has a lot to do with how toxic our environment is. All the chemicals that are in our food supply, our water, our air, and so forth, that somehow they think that it's messing up with the body weight of little girls. But historically, little boys have always far outweighed little girls. We also know that the heavier the birth weight, the more likely the child is going to survive. We got a big old fatty baby and we got a little skinny baby. Chances are fatso is going to be the one that's going to survive, right? And so I think that instead of seeing this as God is being, God hates little girls and God likes baby boys better. Instead of that, I see it's just the opposite. I see that the Lord is saying, all right, now if you have a baby girl, you're going to have birth weight. It's going to be a little lower. And so let's take her and her mother. Let's isolate her for a couple of months. Let's get a little bit of weight on those bones of hers before we take her out in public and have, you know, Uncle Saul cough all over her face or whatever it is and make her ill. So I really see that this is sensitivity towards the little girl and not any kind of judgment. Now notice too in verse 8. Now when the days of her purification are fulfilled, this is mom, right? Now notice, whether son or daughter here, she shall then bring to the priest a lamb of the first year as a burnt offering and a young pigeon or turtle doves as a sin offering to the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So now notice that this sacrifice applies for a boy or a girl. There's no difference in sacrifice. He doesn't say, well, if you've got a little boy, bring a lamb because, you know, he's not really going to be that big of a sinner. And if you got a little baby girl, well, you better bring an elephant, all right? You better bring an elephant here. It's the same sacrifice for both. There's no favoritism going on here whatsoever. And then finally verse 7, notice again the repeat here that this is the law for her. Again, mother who has borne either male or female. Then notice verse 8. Now, if she is not able to bring the lamb, that is, she can't afford a lamb. It's too expensive. The family does not have money. Then she shall bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons. Now, the reason for two is that one would be a burnt offering, and then the other would be, notice, the sin offering. And so the priest shall make atonement for her And notice then that she will be clean, and she now comes back into fellowship, so to speak, with the rest of the group. Now, I think that it's interesting that the Lord here, that he makes a special provision for people that just can't afford it. Isn't it interesting that the Lord wants to be worshiped, and the Lord wants to make it possible for all of his children to participate in these kinds of things? And he's very sensitive that if there are going to be people that they can afford this stuff, and there are going to be people that they're not going to be able to afford it. Well, thank goodness that the Lord allows, the Lord lowers the cost of admission, the price of admission, shall we say? And what is interesting about that is that you remember that when Mary and Joseph, when they came on the eighth day and they were presenting Christ, you remember that what Luke tells us is that they came to offer a sacrifice according to that which is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. Isn't it fascinating that the Lord, he's sovereign. He could have chosen any kind of family to have the Lord Jesus born into. And he deliberately chose a poor family. Now, again, remember, this is long before the wise men have showed up, right? The wise men show up. Jesus might have been 2 years of age at that time. Remember that the wise men, that they saw not the infant, but they saw the young child, all right? And then Herod went and killed all the babies that were 2 years of age and younger. So this is long before they've received the gold and the frankincense and the myrrh. These are two teenagers that are dirt poor, and they're going to be obedient to what God has laid out. And so they're able to afford a couple of birds, which at that time would only be, you know, a half a cent, you know, a quarter of a cent. Not a lot of money for these kinds of animals. But I think here's the point for you and I, particularly some of you that have young children, that the Lord placed his son in a family that could not buy his son nice things. And I think by doing that, I think that the Lord is showing us, when it comes to raising a family, what really should have the priority. Now, I think that we're seeing, and I've certainly seen it in my lifetime, I think there's been kind of an evolution in the relationship between a parent and a child. You know, when I was growing up, and I'll do my best not to sound like grandpa, all right? When I was growing up, you know, I remember that my parents, they didn't come to my, you know, little league games. When junior high basketball games, I don't remember my parents coming to those kinds of things. And of course, now things are much different. Now, again, when I was young, there was a generation gap. I did not want to wear the same kind of clothes that my parents, you know, had wore as children. I didn't want my hair to look like their hair when they were kids. I certainly was not interested in listening to their music. Isn't it interesting how we're seeing a closing of that generation gap between moms and dads and younger children today? I mean, I like the music that my kids listen to. And we don't really dress all that much differently. And we kind of enjoy the same kind of music, and we really don't care much about hairstyles and that kind of a thing. And I think that what is happening within the culture is that there is that desire for the parent to want to be the friend as opposed to the authority figure, as opposed to the one who instructs, the one that gives counsel, the one that, you know, gives guidance and so forth. And I think that sometimes parents can feel bad that they can't buy their kids, and probably social media even makes this worse, you know, that, you know, here's a family at your child's school, and here they are at the Great Wall of China at spring break, you know, here they are in the yacht, you know, and all of these incredible things, and, you know, I mean, you got to slip and slide in your backyard, you know, that's the best that you can do. And sometimes I think that parents feel bad that they can't buy their children some of the things that they see other parents buying their children. And I think that it's good for us to remember that what the Lord was looking for when he was picking a parent for his son. that he did not pick somebody that could buy nice things, but rather he picked somebody who obviously was going to live a sincere faith before his son. And I think that it's quite clear that being raised in that house that he was raised in, that there was modeled for him integrity. There's something that is far more important than gifts and money for your children, and that is an unhypocritical faith. And where it starts is that it starts with the small things in life, that just every day I'm going to be obedient to what the Lord has laid out for me. I'm going to serve him, even in the most minute detail that I sense a conviction about. I'm going to be obedient to my Lord.